Good morning, everyone. I'm Asha Nayaswamy. We're continuing with our shelter-in-place conversations about the gurus of this line. I think we've spent 3 days on Lahiri, and I think this will be our final day talking about Lahiri Mahashaya. So let's start with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master Paramahansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, dearest friend Swami Kriyananda, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to open our hearts and minds to your transforming presence. We long to live in the joy of thy light and thy unconditional love. Help us to focus our attention in all circumstances on your guiding presence, that our deepest aspirations and the greatest longings of our hearts will be fulfilled in thee. Om. Peace. Amen. I received an email from friends in India who appropriately suggested that speaking of Lahiri Mahashaya only as Lahiri was not entirely appropriate. Mahashaya is his honorific, and Mahashaya means great soul. Lahiri was literally just his family name. Smith Jones, it just was his family name, Shyam Charan Lahiri. So when I'm calling him Lahiri, I'm calling him like calling him Smith, which to American ears, Lahiri is an exotic sound, and so it doesn't sound like something as mundane as it sounds to Indian ears. So I know this question came up when Swami Kriyananda first moved to India in 2003. He had just written Conversations with Yogananda, and he wanted immediately to publish it in India. It had just come out in the American side. And he was called Conversations with Yogananda. And the Indian devotees felt that that was not respectful to one's guru to just call him Yogananda. And they felt, you know, Paramhansa should be there, preferably Sri Sri Paramhansa Yogananda Maharaj. And there's just a lot of ways, and all of it is extremely well intended. And also you add the suffix J-I to the end of a name, which means both reverence and respect. Swami Kriyananda, we always call him Swamiji, because that's just a little more. It's both affection and respect. It's intimate without being disrespectful. I mean, it's become a habit. When I go to India, people will call me Asha Ji, Jaya Ji, Amit Ji, Daya Ji. You sort of get used to it. When I was in Israel, traveling with our modern Orthodox Jewish guide, whose name was Rami, I started calling him Rami Ji. It just sort of by habit. And he sort of, you know, was a little puzzled because he was way outside of such a tradition. But I'd absorbed it enough into myself. But when Swamiji was told he should change the title of that book, he said he didn't think it was necessary. He felt that there's a certain amount of habit that even though it is well-intended and it is sincerely offered, it doesn't need to become dogma. And Yogananda in that context is a spiritual name. So Yogananda was the monastic name that Master took. He was Mukunda Lal Ghosh. And when he became Yogananda, then he had abandoned his birth name and had now taken on a spiritual name. And it means bliss through union with God, through yoga, which means union in that sense. So Swami didn't feel it was disrespectful, and he often writes about Yogananda just for the simplicity of language. So I was a little bit in a dilemma when I got the note, but Lahiri isn't a title of any kind. It is just his birth name. So I will do my best to call him Lahiri Mahashaya. I think it's more appropriate, and if disrespect has been offered, I sincerely don't mean it. And I don't like to plead cultural ignorance, but it's primarily, and I guess I'll say it again clearly, because Lahiri sounds to an American ear like a title. It doesn't sound like a name. So if I had thought that I was just calling him Shyam, which I recognize as a name, I would never have done that. I'm saying it also because these are interesting things when we go east and west. Sometimes small cultural issues loom extremely large in the minds of whoever's on either side of it. In India, for example, touching the feet of a spiritual teacher is so fundamental that you simply can't, out of shyness or modesty, prevent it from happening. You watch adults, parents teach their children from a very tiny age. You know, children who are 2 years old will come up in pranam and touch your feet just because it's so much in them. And when it's sincere, which it almost always is, it's actually very touching. Swamiji, as he himself put it, "I don't feel honored when people touch my feet." He said, "I feel blessed." And he said, "I also feel blessed because it's a transmission of energy from," as Swami said, "from my guru to people." And that was the way we were thinking of it. So I thought it was worth addressing before I went on talking about Lahiri Mahashaya. When I also, these are just, you know, I had referenced a book that has been published, and it was written, I believe, in Bengali and translated into English, that includes excerpts from there were 26 diaries that Lahiri Mahashaya kept of his inner spiritual experiences. And there was a book that is excerpts and a lot of commentary. The book is highly unsatisfactory. I didn't even mention the name of it all. Although if you work hard, you can find it. It was highly unsatisfactory. I didn't even keep it. I passed it on, which you would think would be strange, because if you have Lahiri Mahashaya's diary, you would think you would want to keep it. But the commentary was so interwoven, it got very confusing. I have since learned that there's some controversy about that book, as to whether or not the pieces of the diary were lawfully obtained or not, and whether or not the author was actually qualified to write the book. I don't know. I have no answer. It's a wonderful book because it gives you access to something that's not published elsewhere. At the same time, it's a confusing book because it's not clearly written. So I'm just going to leave it at that. But since I referenced it, when I heard that there was some question about the history of that book, I decided to be more neutral about it. So now, the diaries are actually the point of what I wanted to talk about Lahiri Mahashaya, because in these 3 days, I've taken us on a tour of Varanasi and walked in and out of Lahiri Mahashaya's house, and I've been down the Ganges in the moonlight. So there's been lots of other parts. And one of the main things that I've been talking about in reference to Lahiri Mahashaya is that he's called in our line of gurus the yoga avatar, the avatar of yoga practice, because of his deep dedication to the practice of Kriya and his advice that has been reported to us, which is no matter what question was raised, no matter what personal issue was brought to him, his answer was always the same, which is do Kriya. Now, to be clear, most of you watching this, this is more for somewhat for the family, but people will stumble upon this who don't know. The word Kriya simply means action, and many spiritual lineages have Kriyas, and Kriyas are whatever specific spiritual practice is part of their sadhana. Sadhana means specific spiritual practices. Whatever practices are part of their sadhana, they call them Kriyas. So earlier on, I mentioned that Swami Kriyananda says the Kriya of Lahiri Mahashaya to define precisely which action it is. The Kriya that has come down through this lineage was not created by anyone in this lineage. it is a restoration of ancient method of attuning, directing inner energy to the spiritual eye. Our problem in life, and this is why the Hiri Mahashaya gave the advice he gave, is that our energy self, which is the astral spine, which is the chakras, the centers in the body in which vrittis of energy, which is to say karma, unlearned lessons, the delusions that we still hold that tell us that we need something other than God in order to feel fulfilled. And as vrittis in the chakras, these are not passive ideas. Vrittis are whirlpools, and what is in the chakras are whirlpools of energy with a center point of some center point of delusion. I need to be secure in the world. I need to be loved. I need to be attractive in a certain way. I need to be not criticized. I need to have power. Whatever it might be, there's some center point, and then a whole circle of energy gets going around it. In order to have power, I have to have money. In order to have money, I have to have a business. In order to have a business, I have to be aggressive. I need to be ruthless to my enemies. But the center point is I need power, and therefore I need money. And then all this energy spins, and we incarnate lifetime after lifetime. You know, I need to be loved. I need to be the center of a household. I need to be a beautiful woman. I need to have men admire me. You know, so all of these things start building. I need to incarnate in a family where they all look good, so that all look good. I need to incarnate into wealth so that I can be well taken care of and don't have to wear myself out with work. All of these things, you can see they all spin. And so we incarnate time after time to try to fulfill that ideal of what we need to be happy. And the whole process of reincarnation, the soul's long journey from delusion to enlightenment, is we have to keep testing out those different theories and see how well they're going to work for us. And sometimes we actually get what we want, and we find not that it makes us unhappy, but we find the limits of how happy it can make us. Because if we never get something we think we have to keep trying because we still believe it's going to make us happy. So eventually, we will get what we want. And sometimes it ends in heartbreak, but even if it doesn't end in heartbreak, it ends in, you know, there it is. I had everything I wanted, but it's still not enough. That's when spiritual life really begins, because we've really drunk that cup to the bottom and we're still thirsty. So Kriya, the Kriya practice of Lahiri Mahashaya, this ancient practice, works directly with the energy in the spine. It works directly with the chakras, and it's a method, it's an extraordinarily powerful method by which we can dissolve those vrittis. Those vrittis are just a pattern of energy, and there is the direct energy flowing up and down the spine, and the vrittis are like a whirlpool on a river. It's like it's the same river water, but instead of flowing in a direct line to the sea, it gets sucked off and whirls, goes nowhere. It just keeps going in a circle, but it keeps sucking energy out of the river, and then it just hangs out there. Eventually, it's got to go to the sea because all water has to go to the sea. And so eventually, our vrittis have to be dissolved at the spiritual eye. But how long, Lord? Oh, how long? So we work through those vrittis by acting them out in the world, or, and this is where the power of Kriya Yoga, as it was taught by Lahiri Mahashaya and through this line, is that by increasing the flow of energy up and down the spine according to this comparatively simple but nonetheless esoteric method, the flow of energy up and down the spine directed toward the spiritual eye running through all the chakras becomes powerful enough that it's more powerful moving toward the spiritual eye than it is to hold that whirlpool in place. And so the vritti literally just gets dissolved, just thinking about a river and a whirlpool. If the flow of the river is strong enough, the whirlpool can't hold out against that flow anymore, and all that water just enters the river, and it literally disappears. It's absorbed into the greater flow. So we are nothing but a pattern of energy. And when we practice Kriya or a technique like it, but this technique is particularly powerful, with the grace of the gurus, because it cannot be separated from discipleship, with the grace of the masters, Yogananda said, you know, one round of Kriya, which is an inhalation and an exhalation done in the right manner, is equivalent to 1 year of right living. So it can spend, you can spend a year sort of loosening up that vritti, or you can spend less than a minute doing one Kriya done properly. That's the little caveat that's just sort of slipped in there, but done properly, which isn't that hard, but nonetheless. And you will dissolve the same amount of karma. So you can see it's that's why they call it the airplane route to God. So Lahiri Mahashaya is, okay, let me just make sure that I have that all that thought there. So Lahiri Mahashaya saying to people, oh, you're having trouble with your family. Oh, you're having trouble with your finances. You're having trouble with your health. You're disappointed in your children. You're not able to have children, and that makes you sad. You know, your father has died, and you're lonely for your father. Just make a long list of everything that a person could make a list. All of it represents a vritti in the chakra. All of it represents a single thought, some thought, central concept around which we have built a whole lot of other desires, but they're all held in place by the central concept. If I think I have to be a beautiful woman and admired and all these other things in order to be loved, and then I need all those other things, you know, I need long hair and I need people to take care of it and I need a beautiful home, I need lovely clothes and I need age-appropriate care for myself and all of these other things. But if I get rid of the idea that I need to be a beautiful woman and need to be loved, then everything else just goes away too. So Kriya also works on those central ideas, because those central ideas are what I call alternate theories of happiness, which is all of the scripture tells us that the heart is restless until it finds its rest in God. That was what St. Augustine put it. But we were made for thee alone. And all longing for fulfillment and happiness in this world is a misdirected longing for union with God. Now, I wish it were just so easy to say, oh yeah, that's a good idea. I think I'll just search for God. Yeah, you know, why not? These are not intellectual. These are based on very deep longings of the soul. It's not simple to realize God, although I'm going to add a wonderful thing that Master said. Master said in India, where there's as he was talking about, especially when he first arrived in America, he said in India, they've known about God realization, of course, forever. And they understand what it means. They understand what the project is. And because they believe in reincarnation, they will say, oh, yes, Master, in this lifetime, you know, I must fulfill my duties as a householder. Maybe in some future lifetime, I will realize God like this, because they know how hard it is and what's really involved. He said, you come to America, Americans, it's a blank slate. You know, nobody's ever really talked to them about realizing God. And Master talked about America's marvelous can-do spirit. You know, we're kind of a joke around the world because we're just so out there, you know, we can do it sort of thing. I remember traveling in India with an American friend who was an engineer. And we were stopped by the roadside and we saw the women going, it was all women working, going down the hill, filling a basket with rocks, putting it on their head, and then coming back up the hill and then dumping it on the road. He just stood there and he said, I'm too American, but I would build a machine. You know, of course, then all those people would be out of work. So there's another side to it. But there's this American spirit. So Master said, so when he would say to American audiences, you can realize God, they would say, sure, let's do it. You know, just we can do it like that. Just this eagerness. And because of that, and because of the practical energetic nature of the American temperament, many did. And many made great progress. And that is I mean, I'm digressing, but only slightly. That's one of the reasons why Master came. Why didn't Master start this work in India? He started this work in America. He started this work in Southern California. You know, just because it needed a completely new spirit. It needed a Dwapara Yuga way of looking at things that wasn't burdened by all those wonderful thousands of years of tradition, but all those thousands of years of tradition just weigh people down. Whereas when he came to California, it was just a completely fresh slate. So all this new energy that has now literally by Swami Kriyananda also just carried been back to India, meeting, interestingly, you know, especially the younger generation of Indians who have this very East-West idea, who love their culture but are themselves bewildered by the burden of thousands of years. But this American-based clarity and simplicity of, sure, we can do this. And I know when I've been teaching over there, which I have done, you know, a fair amount, not like my American friends who have taken up residence there, but I've traveled there. It's interesting because I have to help them understand that, no, actually, they don't understand what I'm teaching. Yes, they know more about the esoteric of the Mahabharata than I could ever know. But no, they don't actually know what I'm teaching them, because what Master brought as self-realization, as the Kriya Yoga of Lahiri Mahashaya, is not Hinduism. It's really something completely else. However, now to go back to Lahiri Mahashaya, because this is our last day with him, I just want to make it clear what he was really trying to tell us, and why it adds in, but doesn't replace, you know, the rest of what the other of our masters teach us. But Lahiri's specific sort of standalone objective was to make sure that we understand that when everything else is worked out and settled, we're trying to do one thing, which is we're trying to liberate ourselves from all of those alternate whirlpools of energy. And when, by the time we get to Master, especially, and the time we get to Kriyananda, which we will in the course of these conversations, we're very active. We're starting a new work. We're an invading army of new ideas, trying to establish a beachhead on the shore of a hostile people, in a certain sense. I mean, it's not like I want to array myself against my own brothers and sisters who are not interested in the spiritual path, but it is a really new idea, and it's a very active one. But back at the beginning of it, what we have not only Babaji in the Himalayas, but the first proponent of this path lived in the most humble, the least public way. Sri Yukteswar is close to him, but very, very unpublic. And what he did was he meditated. And in these 26 diaries, we still do not have access to in the way that we'd like to have access to them, he reflected on the practice of Kriya. And he reflected on going deep into the spirit. Now, maybe I'll be proved inaccurate about this, because my understanding of these diaries is not extensive by any means at all, and all I've seen is fragments of it in the book that I've referred to. But what it did is it put into perspective for me that how, and this is the point I also want to make, how he who meditates also serves, because Lahiri was radiating this extremely powerful energy and also doing all this research in a certain sense. You know, he left behind, and someday presumably we'll have worldwide access to these books. What did he say? What was he thinking? How did he direct us? What more is there that we haven't yet been allowed to see? And at the very least, when we're trying to meditate deeply, Lahiri Mahashaya would have the vibration that we really want. He sat in the living room of his house after he retired, which I used to know the exact years, how long it was, how many years after he met Babaji, did he continue to work? And then how many years did he just sit in his living room? But it was notable. Day and night, never sleeping, hardly ever leaving the room. He just sat there and meditated, and his disciples would come. And then every so often, I presume, he would talk about the Bhagavad Gita or talk about something else, and he would say to them, do Kriya to solve your problems. Now, we have to balance that, and that's why I'm talking about all our masters. And earlier, I believe, when I was talking about Lahiri Mahashaya, I quoted that incident with Swamiji where someone protested that at Ananda we work too much, and that Master said we should only work a little and meditate, and Swami said that's for later. But later, in the context of cosmic time, doesn't mean that the energy isn't already in motion. Now, this is very peculiar to have five avatars. Almost all spiritual works are started by one, but there's five. And so you have this marvelous capacity to have, I mean, each master, by definition, contains the whole of the spiritual path, because each is fully God realized. But they're a different facet of the diamond. So for the times when we ourselves are feeling that, you know, because I've certainly found in my life, you know, sometimes meditation is going to solve the problem, and sometimes it won't. Even if Lahiri Mahashaya said it would, it won't for me. It requires service. It requires action. It requires chanting. It requires whatever it might require. But it's not, I can't access it. It's too deep, or it's too restless, or it's too annoying. So all of these different things work. But what Lahiri can give to us is just that deep feeling inside ourselves that no matter what else I'm doing, everything comes down to where is my consciousness focused? Am I living from inside, deep inside myself, expressing myself outward, or am I just on the periphery, you know, sort of trying to move the pieces around and make it work? I've always had this, which I think was the seed, I mean, literally the seed of madness for me in previous incarnations, this the pressure of consciousness. And maybe some of you will relate to that, and maybe some of you won't. The fact that I'm always here, that I'm just always here. And I can feel, even whenever I talk about it, I can feel. Swamiji said, madness is a necessary stage on the spiritual path, because at a certain point you realize what you're up against, and one seeks an alternative in just twisting the mind into subconscious, into going into a subconscious reality. But the obvious answer that has occurred to me, really actually largely from thinking so much about Lahiri Mahashaya, is that you become conscious of bliss. And you're not really self-conscious. The terror of it is imagining that self is the center of consciousness. That extraordinarily vulnerable, and I'll use another word, boring, reality of being yourself. This was Master's anguishing monotony that he spoke of in Autobiography of a Yogi, the anguishing monotony of always being here. But you see, do more Kriya, because when we shift our consciousness literally from the medulla, which is the seat of ego, to the spiritual eye, we're still conscious, but we're not conscious of self anymore. Or we recognize, well, I'm going to say something too obvious. We enter a state of self-realization, except it's no longer the ego-based medulla self, it's the Christ self here. And Lahiri kept it simple. Oh, something is troubling you? Shift your self-definition from ego to divine, and everything else that you long for will follow. It's a powerful element of the ray of grace that is this path, and one for which we must always be grateful to Lahiri Mahashaya for exemplifying it so perfectly. God bless you, my friends.